27% of the city, and I have all the power here.
Wow, that was a random number.
You messed with the wrong guy, and you're going to pay for it with your life.
My life? I expected him to finish his sentence with Dr. Jones and laugh diabolically. What was with this guy?
I am placing a bounty on your head for $12 million. You have 24 hours to live.
I'd never had a bounty placed on my head before, and I actually felt kind of fruit, like I was the outlaw Josie Wales. Sans Tarantino commentary, of course. But there was something I had to know. Is $12 million a good bounty? I asked, feeling like Larry David. Like in the grand scheme of things, is that a lot of money to pay for someone's head? If I were, say, Mel Gibson, would it cost more to have me executed?
Careful, man, Jack Swagger warned me in a panic. This is the Wild West over here. You can't talk back to these guys.
He was probably right, but I didn't know how things worked in Abu Dhabi and was curious. Maybe placing bounties on people's heads was an average thing over here, like playing Parcheesi or going to Applebee's was in the States. But if I only had 24 hours to live, then I needed to know the answer to one more question. Okay, I understand you're going to pay somebody $12 million for my head, but if your dad owns 27% of this city, then why are you driving yourself around in a Dodge Charger? Uni fumed and Swagger cringed, worried that I was poking a bear. My eyes drifted to the top of the buildings across the lot and wondered if there was a rifle scope trained on my head at that very moment.
You have one day to live, he reiterated
as he got in the Charger, followed by all five of his cronies. They kept filing in as if it was an ugly clown car, until they were all stuffed in like a pack of teenage girls driving to the mall. They were practically sitting on each other's laps, and their intimidation factor pretty much flew out the open window of the Charger at that point.
24 hours,
Uni said one last time as one of his minions squished up against his shoulder from the back seat. He gunned down the road and squealed the tires around the corner as Swagger and I started laughing and waved bye-bye. By the way, in case you're wondering, I did not die within the 24-hour time limit. I was excited to tour Brazil as I'd never been, and the WWE was now headed there for the first time to try to open up the possibly lucrative market. But the tour got off to a rocky start when our first flight out of the States got canceled, and we didn't arrive in Sao Paulo until a few hours before the show. It was a hot, steamy evening, and I was already sweating as I prepared to face off against Punk in the main event. There it is again. I'm such a worker. The crowd was a decent size, but hardly a sellout, and they'd been fairly quiet throughout the show, as if they were still trying to figure out what it was they were watching. Maybe they just wanted to see dancing. The arena security, made up of members of the Brazilian army, lounged around the arena with their guns displayed on their hips to remind everyone who was in charge. Punk came down to the ring and got a good reaction when he hopped on the apron, waving a Brazilian flag that a ringside fan had given him. As he marched past me, brandishing the banner, I thought about snatching it out of his hand, but he didn't come close enough. He draped it on the turnbuckle, and ref Mike Chioda took it to hand back to the fan. "No, give me that flag, Mikey," I hissed. I wanted to do something to wake the crowd up, so I took the flag from Chioda, dropped it to the mat, stomped on it twice, and kicked it to the floor in a hail of boos. It was a standard heel tactic that I had used many times before, but even that didn't get the response I was expecting. People were mad, but not jumping out of their seats wanting to kill me mad, which was what I was hoping for. We began the match, and I had just started getting heat on Punk about 5 minutes later, when I noticed out of the corner of my eye a second ref in the ring. Did Chioda get hurt?
"Stop the match now,"
Charles Robinson whispered in my ear, but I ignored him and continued my beatdown.
"Seriously, Chris, you have to stop the match now and apologize for kicking the flag or you're going to get arrested."
I stopped kicking Punk and took a step back. The entranceway was now swarming with Brazilian soldiers, all of them glaring at me. Then John Laurinaitis ran down the aisle, waving his arms and yelling,
"You need to apologize now, Chris. This is real, so don't joke around."
I could tell by Johnny's demeanor that there was some serious shit going on. So I grabbed the mic in the center of the ring and addressed the crowd as Punk sold his beat down in the corner. "I just want to say that I would never purposely disrespect the country of Brazil or your beautiful flag. I did what I did to entertain you, and I would like to sincerely apologize to everybody here in the arena and to the entire country of Brazil. I'm sorry." The crowd applauded respectfully, but seemed a bit confused, as if they were wondering why I was apologizing in the first place. I turned my attention back to Punk, who had been waiting in the corner patiently, and like a kid yelling "game on" after a car zooms by in the middle of a street hockey game, I continued my match. Punk won the bout, and then wore the flag like a cape as he made his ringside victory lap, slapping the fans' hands all the way. His lionizing of the banner was the payoff to me kicking it earlier and was what he had planned the entire time. Bad guy assaults flag, good guy assaults bad guy, then beats him, and gets revenge on behalf of the entire country. I felt that having to give the apology in the middle of the match was a little overdramatic, but if that's what the authorities needed in order to calm down, then so be it. But when I walked through the curtain, everybody was staring at me with a threatening glare, like I was Flounder walking into the roadhouse to see Otis Day and the Knights. I went past a group of soldiers, and their eyes bored a hole straight through me, with one older guy in particular, who looked like the Nazi that Indiana Jones throws through the windshield of the truck in Raiders of the Lost Ark, giving me the real stink eye. Dean Malenko, the road agent on the tour, along with Johnny, rushed over and pulled me into his office. "When you kicked the flag, that old guy went crazy. He's some sort of colonel and wanted to rush the ring and arrest you right then and there. We had to beg the guy not to do it, and he settled for an apology, but he's still furious. He thinks all of this is real and wants to take you right to jail." I could only imagine having to spend the night in a Brazilian prison wearing nothing but my sparkly short little wrestling trunks. I'd be targeted as a ladyboy instantly. That was a dash of cold water reality, and I realized just how much trouble I was in. I hurried back to the dressing room and changed my clothes just in case the colonel changed his mind and decided to take me away. I also thought I'd better text Vince and head this off at the pass before he found out from somebody else and things got out of hand like the London glow stick incident. I shot him a message explaining that I had upset the Brazilian army by kicking a flag and I wouldn't do it again on future tours. Vince replied immediately. "There will be no more Brazilian tours for you or any of us. The WWE will no longer be allowed to perform in Brazil in the future. WTF, Chris." I don't know who told him we wouldn't be able to go back to Brazil, but I tracked down our marketing rep and asked if that was the case. He said he hadn't heard anything along those lines, but it didn't matter because Vince was already seething. I texted him back and told him I'd kicked flags a dozen times before in the States, Canada, Mexico, Japan, and nobody had ever been this upset before. But Vince wasn't having it. "It was effing stupid. When was the last time I allowed this kind of shit? 1985? Go home, you're suspended. We will talk when you get back to the U.S. Thanks for ruining what would have been a great market for us. Who knows how this is going to hurt us elsewhere?" Suspended? Now I was pissed off. After all I'd done for the WWE over the years, he was going to punish me for doing my job as a heel? I called him immediately, and he barked that he was too mad to talk and not to call him again. So I texted him and told him he should have my back in a situation like this instead of turning on me. Then I started getting messages from random people saying they read on WWE.com that I'd been suspended. I went online and read the headline. "Chris Jericho has been suspended indefinitely due to an irresponsible act of denigrating the Brazilian flag." The word denigrating had Vince's fingerprints all over it, so I knew he had written the statement himself. It bugged me that he had posted the info so quickly, as he really could have just ignored the whole thing. But he felt the WWE had to officially acknowledge the incident and deal with it before videos of the incident popped up on YouTube. I asked him if he'd even seen what happened. He hadn't, because if so, he would know that I didn't do much more than lightly stomp on the flag and slide it out of the ring with my foot. Vince didn't care and created a self-fulfilling prophecy, because once WWE.com posted the info, it spread quickly. "Great! The story just broke on TMZ," Vince texted me. "That's because you posted the info 30 minutes earlier," I fired back. In Vince's mind, he had to suspend me to cover his ass with the Brazilian government, as well as other countries around the world that he hoped to do business with in the future. I couldn't blame him for it. He had to show that if any of his employees insulted a country or broke the rules, they would be dealt with immediately. And I had broken the rules, since kicking a flag was a felony in Brazil, although that was something I wish they would have told me before the show. Now that I'd been kicked off the tour, there was a mad scramble to find me a flight out of Brazil. Rather than leave me there by myself and take the chance I'd get carted away by the authorities in the middle of the night, Vince decided it would be best for me to take the overnight charter to Ecuador with the rest of the crew and fly home from there the next day. He eventually called to make sure I was safe and to say he wanted me out of the country ASAP. He made it clear that under no circumstances was I to allow myself to be separated from the rest of the company, and then explained why he was so angry at me.
"These people have nothing but pride for their country. All they have is the flag and what it represents. What if the fans had rioted and somebody got hurt? That would have been on your hands."
The irony was I had kicked the flag to try and get the fans to riot. In retrospect, it was a bad idea. Vince then said we'd talk in the morning about how long my suspension would last, and hung up. It was time to board the plane, but as soon as I was walking down the jetway, I was stopped by a soldier. After Vince's warning not to get separated, I envisioned myself being dragged away in a ball and chain in front of my co-workers. The guard looked at me menacingly, reached into his pocket, and pulled out a camera. We took a picture together with his crew, and I boarded the plane. Just as we were taking off, I shot Vince one last text and told him I had made it out of the country, and thanked him for checking up on me.
"I love you, you idiot. AC/DC's still the best band."
I told him I loved him too as the wheels left the tarmac and flew me out of harm's way. I woke up in Quito, Ecuador to another handful of texts asking me what I thought about being suspended for a month.
A month?
I hadn't heard anything from Vince since the night before, so once again I surfed over to WWE.com to find out private information about my own life, the same way I found out I'd been drafted to SmackDown a decade earlier. I was livid at Vince. How dare he inform his social media minions about my punishment before telling me first? Ironically, a few minutes later, I got a text from Vince asking if I was having any fun yet, and to call him. But there was no way I was going to call him, as the battle lines had been drawn. I felt double-crossed and disrespected, and had nothing to say to him. I spent the whole day in the hotel room stewing, the disgraced pariah who wasn't even allowed to go to the arena with the rest of the crew. That night I was given a police escort to the airport, I have no idea why, and had to explain to every Tomas, Rafael, and Geraldo why I was flying home at the same time the WWE show was taking place. Once again, as I was boarding the plane, I was stopped by a security guard, but this one didn't want a picture. He wanted me to follow him and led me out the side door of the jetway, the one they use to deliver your gate-checked luggage, onto the tarmac. I was taken to an open hangar and asked to give up my passport. I reluctantly handed it over, even though I'd always been told to never give up my passport. But what choice did I have? Nobody knew I was down here on the runway, and without a passport, I was a nameless, faceless person non grata who could be taken away with no recourse. What if the Brazilians had called ahead and put an Abu Dhabi-style bounty on my head? Was I going to be taken to prison in the middle of the jungle and left to rot like Rambo? After the longest 10 minutes of my life, the soldiers came back with my checked luggage and rummaged through it for a few minutes. Satisfied that I didn't have automatic weapons or a brick of cocaine hidden in my bag, I did in a secret compartment. They returned my passport and escorted me back onto the plane. I flew home and was fuming for the first few days of my suspension, until I realized that having some unexpected time off wasn't such a bad thing after all. I had an amazing family with a gorgeous wife and 3 beautiful children. Weather was great, and I had some money in my pocket. Life wasn't so bad after all. I didn't respond to Vince's next 2 calls, and it was only after he apologized via voicemail that I finally decided to call him back.
"Listen, I'm sorry that the news of your suspension was posted online before I could call you myself. There was a miscommunication with WWE.com, and they released the info without my permission."
I didn't know if I bought this explanation, but it was the closest thing to an apology I was going to get from him. So I dialed his number. I explained that I felt he'd posted the info online as an FU, and then asked if the suspension itself was my only punishment, or if I was going to get fined as well. He told me he'd have to think about it and would get back to me. A few minutes later, I got a call from Triple H, who told me Vince was fining me half of my guarantee for the month that I was suspended. I hung up on him the second the words left his mouth and dialed Vince's number immediately, wanting to hear the verdict from him and nobody else. But he didn't answer. His decision made me even angrier, because if you added up all the money I was going to lose from the suspension and now this fine, it could total over six figures. Batista had been fined 100 grand for directly defying Vince, and here I was standing to lose more than that for something I'd done on the spur of the moment and had no idea was against the rules. I explained this to Vince when he finally called me, and our conversation quickly escalated into an all-out argument. He insisted that he needed to announce to the media that he'd suspended and fined me, to send a message to Brazil and all other countries like it that behavior like mine wouldn't be tolerated. After a 30-minute debate, he dropped the fine to $10,000 and said he never wanted to discuss the matter with me again. When it was all said and done, he never actually took the 10 grand out of my check, so I don't think I got fined anything. Plus, I still got paid my full guarantee, and earned it by spending the next month pulling Ash, Cheyenne, and Sierra on an inner tube around our lake. Not bad work if you can get it. Maybe I should become a professional flag kicker. Chapter 44. Explode at Download. The ironic thing about my 30-day suspension was I had already blocked off 10 of those days for Fozzy to play the 2012 Download Festival with Metallica, Black Sabbath, and Soundgarden. The UK was our biggest market, and with 100,000 people expected to attend, it had the potential to be our biggest gig ever. When we arrived in England the day before the show, rain was coming down in sheets, drenching the festival grounds and causing complete chaos. We spent the evening watching the Weather Channel and hearing reports of the horrible lines of traffic that had caused a few bands to miss their sets. It was the final countdown for Europe, as they had to cancel. The whole site had been turned into a mud pit, and people had retreated into their tents to wait out the freezing rain. We were scheduled to play Saturday at noon sharp, and I was concerned that nobody would even be there to see us with such miserable conditions that early in the day. But there was nothing we could do except prepare for the worst. So we left the hotel at 8 a.m. to give us plenty of time to make it to the festival grounds. The rain had finally stopped, and we were making good time when we rounded a corner and saw a large body of water submerging the road in front of us. It was too big to be classified as a puddle, for it had settled under a bridge at the base of a hill and flowed over onto a sidewalk. The water level had risen higher than the wheel wells of the van, and there was no way we were going to be able to drive through it without totally drenching the undercarriage. We were in some serious trouble, or so I thought. Rich Ward had been on the road for years, and part of his duties when touring with Stuck Mojo was driving the van in their early days. He'd been through situations like this before, and had a plan as he jumped in the driver's seat and drove forward, slowly steering the ship through the angry seas. The Duke maneuvered over to the sidewalk and popped the front passenger side wheel up on the curb, which took the left side of the van out of the water and gave us the traction we needed to drive through to the other side of the puddle. It was a genius move, and even though the right side of the van was covered in mud and water had dampened the entire floor of the vehicle, it didn't matter. We had crossed the River Charonne without paying the ferryman his penny and were free to continue on toward the biggest show of our career. When we arrived at the massive field, the weather was overcast but still holding, and we prayed that it would stay that way at least until our set was done. At 11:30 a.m., we were taken over to the massive stage to set up and prepare for the show. I wondered how many people we'd be playing in front of, because even though it wasn't quite noon, I knew the Download crowd liked to arrive early. How many would there be? 5,000? 15,000? I wasn't even close. There were only about 500 fans scattered about the muddy lawn watching the first band of the day. It was a total letdown. But I promised myself that no matter how many people showed, we were still going to have a great show, and retreated backstage to warm up. 30 minutes later, I was called out of the dressing room as our intro music played. I walked up the lengthy flight of stairs leading to the stage, ready to rock this flock of 500 people like they were 5,000. I ran out in front of the crowd and surveyed the massive field before me. But things had changed, and there weren't 500 people there anymore. There were 35,000. Considering how empty the field had been only minutes before, I was agog, still a great word, and how many people were now out there, and how quickly they'd arrived. It was as if a Hollywood special effects team had added them via CGI. The crowd spanned as far as my eye could see, and the fans in the front row were crushed up against the barricade, almost spilling over into the arms of the dozens of security guards that lined the steel railings. They were loud, they were intense, and they were there to see Fozzie. And now it was time to explode at Download. We only had a 25-minute set, but in that short time we gave Download the full-on Foz experience. We didn't have dragons flying from the ceiling or pyro blasting out of the drum set, but what we did have was pure electric energy that commanded the crowd completely. When we hit the stage, we were the whole effin' show. We opened with Pray for Blood, and over the course of the next 5 songs I climbed the scaffolding of the stage, led the crowd in sing-alongs, and filmed them after stealing the camera from an unsuspecting tech. The fans had a blast as Rich did the famed Duke Dance and played the chunkiest rhythms known to man. Paulie D kicked his leg up past his chin and threw down bass lines that would make Geezer Butler blush. Billy stuck out his tongue and threw shapes like the rock star he is, and Frank performed his patented sticks tricks and lipstick fix, all the while laying down the thunderous grooves like only he can. At the end of the set, the crowd, including a blow-up love doll that was waved in the air the entire show, roared its approval and chanted, "Fozzie! Fozzie! Fozzie!" as we lined up in front of the appreciative thousands and snapped a picture for posterity. We had just played the show of our lives, and our 35,000 friends behind us knew it too. The day got even better when I was summoned into Metallica World, the compound of dressing rooms that acted as their inner sanctum for the day. Lars was waiting and asked how our gig went, mentioning that he'd like to see us sometime. I'm still waiting. I saw James, and we talked about the ups and downs of the caveman diet and how it was affecting our cholesterol levels. It wasn't exactly the conversation I imagined having with him when I was in high school, but I wasn't just a fanboy anymore. After all we'd been through, James was practically my best friend now, right? Right? We got onto the subject of the hotel I'd stayed in the night before and how the guy at the front desk was a total jerk. James told me how he used to get his revenge on those types of people in the early days of Metallica. Whenever we had bad service or front desk assholes, I'd take a dump in a plastic bag and leave it in the bottom dresser drawer of my room. The maids never looked in those things, and a few days later they would have no idea where the horrible smell was coming from. Papa Het giggled. Now that was the type of conversation I imagined having with him when I was in high school. Lars gave me a couple side stage passes for their show, and I watched them play the Black Album in its entirety from only a few feet away. Michael Starr from Steel Panther was checking out the show with me, and I had to tell him the title of each song they played, as he wasn't familiar with the biggest album in heavy metal history. "You've never heard of Sad But True? Nothing Else Matters? Enter Sandman? That's the only one I know. I was always more of a Van Halen guy." That statement alone would have made us instant enemies in 1988, and I would have been obligated to fight him. But since it was 2012, I let it slide. My suspension was winding down, and I was ready to return to work. I'd had a great time being a full-time daddy and husband, but it was time to get back on the road and finish off the last 2 months of my WWE contract. However, during the unscheduled month off, I felt I'd lost all my heel momentum, and it was time to finally give up on my villainous character and turn babyface. I thought it was what the fans wanted, and after 2.5 years of dirty deeds done dirt cheap, it's what I wanted too. The WWE had been promoting my return for a week with an amazing video package they'd put together using footage from Download that made Fozzie look like the biggest band on the planet, and the crowd was pumped and ready to see me. I started the show doing a promo with Cena, and the fans responded to me like a babyface right off the bat. The promo went great, as did our main event match. There it is again. And it was always fun to work with them. It was also fun to share a few cocktails together. So we went out for a few celebratory drinks after the show. The night ended up being pretty tame, but that wasn't always the case when the two of us were together. I'm not exactly Bon Scott, and I don't drink all the time, despite what a lot of the stories in this book might suggest. But when I let loose, it's not often someone bests me when the yeah boys are flowing. But much to my chagrin, whenever I've gone head-to-head with Cena on the drinking fields, I usually lose. I suffered my worst defeat to Cena a few years earlier when we toured Alaska. Despite it being 40 degrees below zero, he wore jeans the whole time and never complained about the cold. After a show in Anchorage, we hit the bar to keep warm and went pretty hard for a few hours. There were plenty of fans hanging around, and John started counseling a troubled young couple, giving them marital advice like a beefy Dr. Phil. They were listening intently, and after some deep soul-searching, agreed with Dr. John that they were made for each other and should call off their impending divorce. Their marriage saved, we staggered back to my room to have a few more drinks. When we got upstairs, I opened the door, and that's the last thing I remembered until I woke up fully clothed under the covers of my bed a few hours later. I had no idea where I was. It almost screamed when I saw a dark figure sitting in the corner of the room. As my bloodshot eyes adjusted to the light, I realized the dark figure was Sina, still drinking and scrolling through my iPod. In the ultimate show of drinking dominance, John had taken off my shoes, tucked me into bed, and was drinking my beer while listening to my tunes. Sina, 1. Y2 Loser, 0. Chapter 45, The Queen at Live Aid Principal. I still had a few months left on my contract, but since I was leaving after SummerSlam to go on tour with Fozzy, I was the lame duck of the company. I had a decent feud with Dolph Ziggler that ended up with him beating me on my last Raw, which caused me to get fired again. It was a scenario that was decided on 2 hours before the show began, when Vince decreed that General Manager AJ Lee was going to force me to put up my career against Dolph's Money in the Bank briefcase. So Vince, Triple H, and I sat in the office going over different scenarios right up until the last minute.
"Can anybody in this place think of a damn decent finish?" Vince snapped in frustration before deciding that after Dolph beat me, I would drop him with a couple of codebreakers and leave the ring with a smile. It was a fruit feeling to walk out of the arena with Y2J chants ringing in my ears, knowing that I had passed the torch to Ziggler to help him get to a new level. Now it was time to hit the road and take Fozzy to a new level as well. After all the momentum we'd gathered from chasing the Grail, we wanted to keep it rolling by making a new record as soon as possible. All of the hard work we'd done over the past few years had paid off, for we'd been signed to Century Media Records, one of the biggest metal labels in the world, by our old friend Paul Gargano, who was now an A&R man with the label. CMR was the biggest record company we'd ever signed with, and was the perfect place for us to showcase who we were as a band. Knowing that we were now under a huge microscope, Rich and I set out to make the best album of our career by writing the type of songs that we did best. It had taken us a few years to get it right, but the sound that the Duke had crafted for Fozzy, and started with Stuck Mojo, consisted of really heavy, groove-based riffs combined with melodic vocals stacked with multiple harmonies. If Metallica and Journey had a bastard child, it would be Fozzy. With so much at stake, we wanted this new record to be our Black Album. Just as Metallica had done on their breakthrough album, we were looking to write a cohesive unit of songs that had a similar vibe and feel, but still had the diversity we were known for. If any song didn't fit that edict, it was dropped. Rich concentrated on writing the catchiest hooks of our career, and if he couldn't imagine an a cappella doo-wop band gathered in a back alley snapping their fingers and singing our choruses, he knew it wasn't working. Rich Ward is an underrated genius, and the amazing music he came up with for the record proved it yet again. His cohesive unit of songs came together over the next few months, from the dark melodies of Spider in My Mouth, to the thrash metal blast beats of Blood Happens, to the ballad, and the first song Billy ever helped write with us, Inside My Head. Every song seemed better than the last. I wrote lyrics inspired by Stephen King stories, Spider, TV shows Dexter and the Walking Dead, Dark Passenger, Walk Amongst the Dead, history books, Storm the Beaches, about the invasion of Normandy that was inspired by a letter I found written by a soldier to his mother right after the famous battle, and Rich's riffs, Sandpaper, the first word that popped into my mind when the Duke played me the slinky main melody. We thought Sandpaper was catchy enough to be the first single off the record, but when I was tracking the vocals, I felt something was missing. I wondered what it would sound like if there was another voice on the chorus, like a duet. My kids insist on listening to the Hits 1 channel on XM whenever I drive them to school. Cheyenne and Sierra love One Direction, and Ash digs Imagine Dragons, although they all like Fozzy.
And I noticed that while many top 40 artists featured guest artists on their songs, Jay-Z featuring Alicia Keys, Lil Wayne featuring Nicki Minaj, Vanilla Ice featuring Gerardo, rock bands rarely did. So I called Shadows and asked him to take a listen to the demo and consider doing the vocals for the pre-chorus, A Cat Scratch, A Whiplash, A Witch Hunt in Black. A few days later, he called me back and said he'd love to be involved, but was going to do two different versions. The first one the way we wanted him to do it, and the second one the way he wanted to do it. His version included additional harmonies he'd come up with and a different arrangement that made it a sleeker and more streamlined song. His input and ideas were invaluable, and it was a huge honor to have him involved on a professional, musical, and personal level. Thanks, Em. Our hard work paid off, as Sandpaper by Fozzy featuring M. Shadows was a success, spending 12 weeks in the top 10 on XM Octane. What's up, Jose? And was the perfect representation of the sound of our new record. We'd entitled it Sin and Bones, which Rich came up with when he sent a text describing how he was turning into Skin and Bones on a European tour, and autocorrect stepped in. When it came time to do a video, I was having a problem figuring out how we could do one without Shadows, whose vocals were featured so prominently in the track. I had the idea of using the moving camera in the woods gimmick from Evil Dead to mask the fact he wasn't there. Then Rich took things further by suggesting we do a full-on Evil Dead homage and found an old cabin in the middle of the woods outside of Atlanta with an adjacent creepy graveyard that we could use for the set. I called Sean McEwen, who had directed Albino Farm, and he wrote an excellent script treatment that perfectly fit the vibe we wanted. Over the next 2 days, we shot a fittingly eerie short film featuring Sam Raimi's moving camera gimmick, hellacious demons attacking the cabin, Fozzie being possessed. Rich couldn't get the white contacts we all were wearing into his eyes, so we just stuck his hair in his face. And satanic vines that molested us and caused our demise. It was an impressive piece of work, especially considering the budget we had, that got even better when Shadows called last minute to say he wanted to be in the video. Sean and Gargano went to his hood in Orange County to film him on a green screen so we could insert him into the video wherever we wanted. Shad's only had a few hours to get everything done, so I got worried when Gargano called me to say there was a problem. Shadows refuses to film anything until he gets some red licorice. I knew Shad's liked to chew on Red Vine's licorice whenever his throat was sore, but he was only lip-syncing for the video. I thought he was being a little bit of a prima donna with his request. But he was doing us a huge favor, and I wanted him happy. Well, if he wants red licorice, then get him some red licorice, Paul. Gargano fired back that it wasn't his job to drive around looking for licorice and said Shads would have to get it himself. I flipped out and told him to stop effing around, but he never replied. A few minutes later, he sent me a picture of a pouting Shadows mid-tantrum with his face turned away from the camera and his arms crossed. I couldn't believe he was acting that way, but I continued blowing up Gargano's phone, telling him to go get some damn red vines. Damn it, Gargano, don't blow this for us. Get him some fucking licorice. The next text I got was a picture of the three of them laughing and giving me the finger. It was boots all over again. Licorice or not, the Sandpaper video was also a success, amassing over 1 million views on YouTube and winning the Rebel Life Media Award for Best Heavy Metal Video of 2012. Now that we had a great video and were confident we'd made our best album ever, we were hoping that everyone else would agree. Our hard work was vindicated when Sin and Bones became the best-reviewed album of our career. Esteemed English rock journalist Malcolm Dome called it a masterpiece, our biggest-selling record, and our highest-charting effort when it debuted at number 1 on the Billboard Heatseekers chart and cracked the Billboard 200 at number 143, a first for us. It also opened the door to the biggest tour of our career, the 2012 Uproar Festival, headlined by Shinedown and Godsmack. While we'd played a few Uproar dates the year before, this time we were asked to headline the second stage for the entire 6-week tour stretching from sea to shining sea, our first ever full-length U.S. jaunt. We played 30 minutes a day and got a great reaction on most shows, especially in Indianapolis where we had 6 circle pits and 8 pairs of flash tits. That's a total of 16 boobies, by the way. Since our set was so short, we decided to adapt what I call the Queen at Live Aid principle. Inspired by Queen's legendary 1985 performance at Wembley Stadium in London, it's been voted the greatest gig of all time, they stole the show with only a scant 20-minute set filled with pure energy and less talk, more rock. It was all the time they needed, and I wanted Fozzie to have the same seek-and-destroy attitude. The Shinedown guys respected our ethic and dug our sound, and I spent most of my nights after the show riding around in golf carts with guitarist Zach Myers. He had a skeleton key that started the carts in all of the venues across the U.S., and we'd cruise the woods surrounding the amphitheaters, scouting out the hidden graveyards and secret streams, and searching the parking lots for stragglers. We found some in Dallas when we saw two girls drinking in their car at 2 in the morning. I grabbed my artist's laminate, walked up to their window, and tapped it with my finger. The chick in the driver's seat slowly rolled the window with a worried look on her face. I flashed my laminate in her face and said, "Dallas police, are those open containers?" She mumbled that they were, but they were waiting for her boyfriend to come get them and weren't going to drive. I berated her for drinking in public and told her that she was in serious trouble with the law. While I was in mid-scold, a pickup truck pulled up and her lumberjack of a boyfriend unfolded out of the front seat, asking menacingly what was going on. Paul Bunyan changed his tone when I flashed my laminate badge and said, "I think you should drop the attitude, son, and watch how you speak to the police. You don't want to end up in jail with these two, do you?" He backed off immediately and began apologizing for his girl's behavior. I confiscated the bottle of Jack they'd been sipping on and told the girls to get into the boyfriend's truck. "If you return to this car within the next 12 hours, it will be impounded, and you will go directly to jail. Do you understand?" All three of them nodded their heads and promised they'd stay away. There was a new sheriff in town, and I had the laminate to prove it. I had so much fun impersonating a cop. I think that's illegal, right? Oops. But I encouraged the whole tour to join in when Fozzie hosted the inaugural Cop Stash Bash, Duke's idea, the best after-show party of the tour. Everyone was required to wear a mustache or grow one of their own, I did, and dress like a 70s cop. There were gallons of red and blue vodka punch, donut holes, and a DJ that played nothing but disco. The bash was a huge success, and afterward we were celebrating on our bus when I glanced out the window and saw Rich approaching the door. There was a partition between the driver's area and the lounge, so I pulled down my pants and bent over to give him a surprise. I heard the sound of the sliding door opening, but Rich didn't react. That confused me, and I couldn't figure out why there wasn't a giggle or at least a groan of disgust. Suddenly, everybody in the lounge burst out laughing, and when I turned around, Rich was standing there with his pants down, eyes closed, and ball bag tucked between his legs, Silence of the Lambs style. We gasped in unison and hiked up our respective pants, realizing how close we'd come to my bare ass grinding into his naked nutsack. Ah, life on the road. Uproar was another win for Fozzie and opened a lot of touring doors for us worldwide, especially in our biggest market, the UK. Dan DeVita booked us on a co-headlining tour with U.S. medlers Soil, who were fairly popular in England a few years earlier, and were making their big return. As co-headliners, we had equal billing and equal set times, but insisted on going on before them even though we had a bigger name than they did in most of the markets. Our theory was that if we went on first, Soil's fans would have to watch us even if they didn't know who we were, which meant we would be playing to the maximum audience each night. The Soil guys were great, which was lucky since we had the worst tour bus of all time. There had been a fuck-up at the bus company, and all that was available was a dark, depressing dirge of a coach that resembled a mortuary on wheels. It constantly reeked of cigarette smoke because the slovenly driver, who looked like the Rancor's keeper, wouldn't stop smoking no matter how many times we asked him not to. On top of that, the damn thing was freezing. Many a night I shivered under the covers in my bunk, fully dressed with my hoodie up and a scarf around my neck as my breath plumed out of my mouth. I couldn't even read a book because my hands got too cold if I took them out from under the blankets. As bad as the bus was, our shows were awesome, and we played to packed houses all across the country in London, Birmingham, Manchester, and Brighton, where, much to my surprise, Rod Smallwood, the manager of Iron Maiden, came to see us. I'd known him for years, and when he told me he was coming and asked what time we were on, I told him 8:30 p.m., even though we were on at 8:45. I figured a guy that busy would probably show up late, and I didn't want him to miss anything. We played a cracking show that night, and I scoured the audience looking for Rod's face the entire set. I didn't see him and thought maybe he had jammed out on us, but minutes after the show was done, there was a knock on our dressing room door. "Rod, I wasn't sure you had made it." "Of course I made it. I told you I would, right?
Did you think I was some kind of creep? You made me wait, though. I was here at 8:15, you wankers, he replied crankily. I asked him what he thought of the show, and he looked at the shirt I was wearing with the Rev's face and Rich's that boasted a ghost face, and said, It was quite good, but you guys shouldn't wear shirts with big white faces on them. They're distracting. Not exactly the offer to tour with Iron Maiden I'd been hoping for, but I told him we'd make better fashion decisions the next time he came to see us. The tour was winding down, and we had just pulled up to the venue in Frankfurt, when I caught a whiff of fresh cigarette smoke drifting through my bunk. There must have been a vent in the driver's area that connected to mine, because I could always smell it the minute he lit up. Cigarette smoke and cold temperatures are a singer's worst enemy on tour, and this fat-ass slob was responsible for both of them, even though we told him dozens of times to turn up the heat and to not smoke on the bus. I'd had enough of his disrespect and was sick of being diplomatic, so I stormed into the venue and straight over to where he was stuffing his chubby face with junk food. Hey, asshole! We've told you a dozen times on tour that there is no smoking on the bus, but you won't listen, and I'm over it. If you light up one more time in there, I'm going to slap your fat face and shove that pack of cigarettes straight up your ass. You got it? The driver yammered an apology in his German accent and fled out of the room. I looked over, and the soil guys were staring at me wide-eyed in fear, with their knees pulled up to their chins. I promise I won't smoke any more either. And I don't even smoke, bassist Tim King whispered worriedly. Chapter 46 Old Habits Die Hard. With the soil tour finished, Fozzie was done touring for a few months, and since I had an open spot in my schedule, I called Vince to see if he was interested in having me back in the WWE from the Royal Rumble to WrestleMania. Contact Triple H, he answered. He's your man. Okay, but you'll always be my man, Vince. There had been a gradual shift in hierarchy during the last few years as Vince was grooming Triple H to take over the company after he was gone. I totally understood that, so I called Hunter, and to his credit, we made the deal for my return in about 10 minutes. I would come back as a surprise entrant in the Rumble and continue on until WrestleMania. Now that I was coming back to the WWE for a fourth run, I started thinking about what I could do to build up my return this time around. The vignettes heralding my previous entries had been so grandiose and classic, I wondered what I could do to top them. Not to mention, I was famous for having the big build-ups, so if any kind of mysterious vignettes aired, people would pretty much know they were for me. So I started thinking it might be a good idea to go in the opposite direction, and keep my return at the Rumble a complete surprise. But was that even possible in this day and age when everyone had a cell phone camera, a Twitter account, a Facebook page, and a big mouth? It seemed like a real long shot that my secret could remain under wraps for that long. There was no reason to go train with Lance again, as I'd only been away from the WWE for a couple months, but there were a few other projects to finish before I returned, the biggest being the web series I'd co-written and co-created called But I'm Chris Jericho. BICJ was an idea that my collaborator Gary Rideout and I had come up with 6 years earlier when I did the play Opening Night in Toronto. The idea was to do a spoof of what I was really going through at the time, when I left wrestling and went to Hollywood to study acting. I started thinking, what if Y2J was kicked out and blackballed from the wrestling business, forcing him to make a career change where he has to start at the bottom of an industry that couldn't care less about who he was or what he'd accomplished in the past? Gary and I wrote a couple sizzler scripts and pitched it around Hollywood in a few different incarnations for a year or two with no success, and I moved on to other projects. But Gary never gave up and called me toward the end of 2012 to tell me he'd sold the show. It had been so long that I asked him, what show? To Shaw Cable as a 10-episode web series. I was proud of his tenacity for sticking with the idea and was excited to show off my comedic skills. We shot in Toronto, and it wasn't easy getting the 10 episodes finished in 5 days, but the shows were so well written that the scenes flew by. We assembled a great cast that included acclaimed actors Scott Thompson from The Kids in the Hall, a comedic genius, Colin Mockery from Whose Line Is It Anyway, and Andy Kindler from Everybody Loves Raymond, who played my bumbling agent. I love the idea of Jericho being the straight man surrounded by a cast of idiots in a world where nothing goes right for him. It ended up being a legitimately funny, in my opinion, body of work, and I was very happy with how it turned out. The episodes have over 1 million views, and if you haven't seen them,
Go check it out on YouTube or butimchrisjericho.com now. If you don't laugh, I'll refund the money you paid to watch it. After filming the final scene where I wore a French maid's outfit, I drove straight to the airport, sadly without the French maid outfit, to fly to Anaheim for the 2013 NAMM convention. NAMM stands for North American Music Merchants, and this was an annual affair where the most famous musicians in the world gathered to do signings and shill for their respective endorsers. It was also a giant party and a chance to see all your friends from other bands who were on the road the majority of the rest of the year. My signing was on Saturday in Anaheim, and since the Royal Rumble was the next day and just a short flight away in Phoenix, NAMM was the perfect smokescreen to fool the fans into thinking I wouldn't be there. Surprisingly, my return still hadn't leaked online, which I considered a huge coup since wrestling websites had been predicting the returns of John Morrison, Shelton Benjamin, and Carlito for weeks, but hadn't mentioned my name once. Plus, I'd been tweeting about my signings at NAMM on Saturday, which were legit, and Sunday, which were not, so the hellhounds had been thrown off the trail so far. The NAMM party was in full swing, and Shadows was also there for a signing. So after my appearances were finished, we headed out to the wilds of the OC to hang out with the other Avenged guys and some of their friends, including a stoic dude named Chris, who I renamed Graham. Not sure why, I guess he just looked like a Graham, you dig? I spent a large part of the night trying to convince Shads and Graham to go see Stryper, as I was stoked to see them again after joining them on stage the prior year to sing their version of the Scorpions' Blackout. I had written in my 1988 high school yearbook that someday I was going to join Stryper. There I was, some 20-odd years later, on stage, filling in for Michael Sweet as their lead singer. It was another awesome dream come true, and I praise God for letting me have that moment. But now that I'd had a few yeah boys, it was time to be professional and split back to the hotel, for I had my big Rumble return the next day and wanted to be well-rested. But on the car ride back to the Marriott, I decided for some reason that I wanted to kiss Graham on the lips. Why he needed a kiss from me, I have no idea, but it made perfect sense at the time. Graham kept refusing, which only made me angrier, and considering I was the guy who'd once spent 3 hours trying to convince The Undertaker to let me kiss him on the lips in Tokyo, he eventually let me give him a peck on the cheek, I wasn't about to give up that easily. We pulled into the parking lot of the hotel, and I gave him one last chance to let me kiss him, but he refused again. So I got out of the car, pulled the driver's door open, and started chasing him. We ran around the car a half dozen times like something from a drunken Three Stooges routine, except there were only two of us, and Graham wasn't drunk. Shadows was in the back seat laughing his ass off as Graham jumped back in the driver's seat and locked the door. I jumped on the hood of the car, like the idiot in Victoria, British Columbia, screaming, "You will kiss me, Graham! You will kiss me!" as a crowd gathered around and hotel security wandered over to see what the problem was. "Sir, you're going to have to get off that car right now," one of them said forebodingly, "or I'm calling the police." I doubted that he was going to be ringing Stuart Copeland, so I put my pride aside and backed down because I knew if I didn't, I'd probably spend the night in jail, miss my flight to Phoenix, and my chance to be the secret entrant in the Royal Rumble, and probably lose my job to boot. I slid off the hood, bashfully telling the rapidly multiplying security force I was only kidding, and got back into the car. Graham quickly pulled out of the lot wearing the exact same facial expression he'd sported all night. My facial expression was one of panic, however, when I woke up late the next morning and had to rush to the airport to catch my flight, only to find to my relief that it had been delayed. Finally, the plane was ready, and it was time to shock the world with a surprise return of the century that still hadn't been leaked. I was starting to feel the adrenaline, and a flock of seagulls flew around in my stomach when I thought about walking through that WWE curtain in just a few short hours. But I was paranoid that a fan was going to spot me and ruin the surprise by posting a picture of me online like they had last time. I had a nervous feeling and hoped I wouldn't be sitting next to anybody who was going to recognize me. But it was just the opposite. I wiggled my way into my window seat and realized I was sitting next to Joe Walsh. We shared a glance of recognition and exchanged greetings. He was wearing a blue nylon sweatsuit and a big grin, and as we were visiting Auntie Bev TM, a lady walked down the aisle holding a plastic pillbox in her hand, the kind that has a compartment for every day of the week. As she was maneuvering between the two aisles of seats, she bumped into an errant elbow and spilled the tablets all over the floor.
"My cranberry pills!"
she yelled in dismay as they bounced off the carpet. I glanced beside me and saw an empty seat, so I looked down and saw Walsh crawling on his hands and knees, feverishly picking up the pills as fast as he could. He looked up at me sheepishly and said, "Old habits die hard, brother." Chapter 47 Favorite Moment of My Career. I landed in Phoenix and crept off the jetway, half expecting a group of fans to be waiting there yelling, "Gotcha!" and snapping pictures to send directly to WrestlingObserver.com. But there was nobody there, so my delayed flight from Anaheim had turned out to be a blessing. Since I had landed almost 2 hours late, the fans were already at the arena for the 5 p.m. start time. The plan was for me to go to the building and head into an underground parking lot where I would once again hide on a crew bus, like I had in 2012, until it was time for my appearance. The airport limo with the tinted windows maneuvered through the mobs of fans milling about the arena, none of them aware that Y2J was inside. We drove down the rampway, and one of the heads of talent relations, Mark Carano, scurried me onto the bus and told me to sit tight. The show started, and I kept checking online to see if I'd been spotted, but unbelievably, there still wasn't one mention of Y2J. Dean Malenko came onto the bus, and after a quick reunion, told me I was going to be the number two entrant in the Rumble, which I thought was a stroke of genius. Having me appear right off the bat would blow the roof off the proverbial joint and create a buzz that would last for the entire 60-minute match. The first entrant would be Dolph Ziggler, the man responsible for my firing, so it made perfect sense from an angle perspective to have me come out next. I was feeling great until I was told I was needed in a meeting with the other 29 Rumble participants to discuss the match. Okay, the jig was up. There was no way that many wrestlers could keep their mouths shut about my return, but almost none of them knew I was in the building and were legitimately surprised to see me. I shook hands, busted Santino's balls, and shared a quick nod of respect with Cena, as we hadn't seen each other for a while. We went over the plan for the Rumble, and it was decided I was going to be one of the final five, which meant I was going to be out there for a while, and that's the way I liked it. I've always been a pressure player. The more responsibility I have in a match, the better. With the order of the Rumble finalized, I went to get a tune-up for my blue light-up jacket from WWE's master prop guy, Mark Shillstone, whose repairs have saved my jacket from ruin dozens of times. Finally, the pre-Rumble package played, and it was time for me to make my way to the ring. Right before I left the sanctity of the bus, I googled Chris Jericho Royal Rumble 2013 for the last time, and once again saw nothing. We'd pulled off the impossible in these social media crazy times and kept a secret. Not one fan in the world knew I was in that building. I walked through Gorilla, shocking the superstars who hadn't yet heard the news, and gave Vince a big hug.
"Thanks for coming back," he said. "I'm really glad you're here."
I was glad to be there as well, and happy to hear the solid reaction of boos Ziggler got when he was announced. He sauntered to the ring and grabbed the mic, challenging anybody from the back to come out as the second entrant. He didn't care who it was, as he was ready to beat up anybody. The arena buzzed with anticipation over who was going to answer Dolph's challenge, and Kevin Dunn kept the audience waiting and waiting until they were ready to burst. Finally, he hit the music, and out boomed my familiar war cry at 50,000 decibels. Break the walls down. I've always said that the biggest reaction of my career was for my 1999 debut against The Rock in Chicago. But as amazing as that one was, the reaction I received right then in Phoenix blew it away. While the fans might have suspected it was me in 99, they had absolutely no idea this time, and because it was a total surprise, they went absolutely wild as a result. It was such a thrill to see the fans, my fans, jump up on their feet and lose their minds when Jericho flashed across the Tron. It was the loudest ovation I ever received in my 22 years of wrestling, and could be the favorite moment of my career. Something I'll never, ever forget. With the roar of the crowd ringing in my ears and my amazing fans awaiting, I adjusted my trunks touched my shoes with a yoga stretch, got a thumbs up from Vince, and strutted through the curtain to do what I do best. Entertain all of you. This concludes The Best in the World by Chris Jericho with Peter Thomas for Natale. Narrated by Roger Wayne. Copyright 2014 by Chris Jericho. This unabridged audiobook is recorded by arrangement with Gotham, a division of Penguin Group USA, LLC, a Penguin Random House company, and was produced in the year 2014 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.